You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to. Courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith, and if I sound strange today, it's because I'm talking into a box full of foam in a tiny, airless, lightless room. This is just another step towards the dream of having my own tiny and ideally portable recording studio that would allow me to smash through these blurbs in a matter of moments. I'm currently trying to build something in a little cupboard under the stairs, but nothing's ever easy. This is Sarah Barron in an episode recorded during the Edinburgh Festival this year. And Sarah, I think, was the second or third show I saw at Edinburgh and really got my festival off to such an exciting start. Brilliant to see someone who I'd never seen before. She's been in the UK for a few years now, but she is an American lady and is completely just such a different voice. You know that feeling when you see someone and go, oh, we haven't got one of them. Well, now we have. Sarah is really, really funny, kind of urgently funny, has a wonderful pressing delivery with loads and loads of energy. But she also, I felt in such safe hands as an audience member. And as I think I mentioned to her in this episode, there were people of all ages doubled over and clutching their friends. It was a really exciting, very, very funny show. So I'm very pleased for you to make her acquaintance. This is Sarah Barron.
Thanks for the show.
Oh
my God, I loved it.
Coming.
I loved it. What I'm used to at this festival is seeing people who I've never seen before, and they're newer because I've often seen people, unless they're kind of an import from somewhere that I've never seen this person. Most of the people that I've been recommending to people are new and exciting and, you know, 90% formed or still having ideas and stuff. It was such a joy to see someone completely new to me. Slight disappointment that you've been in the UK for 7 years and I hadn't noticed that. Yeah. I was like, right. Oh, you're one of us. Okay, fine. But to see someone so formed as a comic and so, I mean, I said to you at the time, I said to you when we saw each other the following day, I saw those American girls on the front who can't have been more than 20.
Oh, right.
The elderly couple who can't have been less than 70. At separate points, clutching each other or kind of hitting, like the woman next to me, Fee, was hitting her friend on the arm. Everyone had that kind of, that sort of natural, like you grab the person next to, I'm relating incredibly hard to this, but just across everyone. It was brilliant. You were brilliant.
Oh, thank you. It's so funny because I had like a moderately rough one on Saturday night. And my husband was in, and I sort of thought it had gone okay. And he was like, oh, rough, like a tougher crowd. I hadn't known it was that tough a crowd, which sort of made me feel a bit unhinged. In other words, like it's sort of like it's that thing if someone sees a photo of you and they tell you it's a good photo and you think it's vice versa. But he was like, and then the long and short of it was that he felt sitting in there on a Saturday night at the Pleasance, that they never united as an audience.
Okay.
But what I felt looking at them was that they were sort of doing okay.
Yeah.
And then I had an okay round of applause, and I was like, oh, it's sort of this show that in ways that are positive and negative.
Okay.
I hope gives a little something to everyone.
I see what you mean.
But there weren't as many.
It wasn't as cohesive.
It wasn't as cohesive. There weren't as many group moments for everyone.
Okay.
Living and learning. Getting through each one.
And this is your second year?
Yes.
At the festival. But you've been going for a while. You've had an unusual journey into stand-up. You started and stopped.
I have had an unusual journey. So I started basically when I was 22. And I was in New York and I was like, I had wanted to be an actor. And very quickly I was like, oh, this is terrible. Like there's...
Because
there wasn't enough... the word is escaping me. But it's like there wasn't enough control. Mm-hmm. Work was irrelevant. Right? You can't work hard enough in a certain way to be an actor. You kind of have to wait for a thing to come.
Of course.
Also, you know, with these things, you want to feel like you're properly good at it because, like, what are you doing? It's so, like, so competitive. Mm-hmm. It's just like, this is terrible. There's not enough, like, work. You know what? I don't even mean, like, there aren't enough jobs. I mean, like, if you decide you want to do stand-up, well, then what you do is sign yourself up to an open mic and write a joke. There's a work you can do. There's no work you can do. You just have to kind of like wait for an audition to come. And you can take classes and whatever, but let's not kid ourselves about
that's not work,
work.
Is it?
Sure. So they do stand-ups, right? So I tried stand-up, but it wasn't like, you know, so many people and so many of our mutual friends, presumably, it's like they were 13 years old and they were obsessed with these comedy albums and Richard Pryor and that, you know, and all this sort of stuff. That wasn't my thing. I was just like watching some late night monologues on TV and was like, oh, that seems, I think.
When you say monologues, what sort of thing?
Like
do you mean?
Conan, like Conan's opening monologue,
like
or Jay
kind of
Leno
monologues.
Or
okay.
David Letterman, right? Like those sort of American talk show hosts. And I started doing it, and it was New York in 2002. So really clubby.
Was that post bust? What was the circuit? Because my understanding of American stand-up is
your understanding is probably better than mine, but keep going.
Well, I feel like 80s, it went bananas. And then I don't really know what happened in the 90s and noughts. I don't know where things... Did it feel like... Was everyone going, wow, there's stand-up everywhere? Or was everyone going, oh, God?
Do you know the honest and embarrassing answer is I don't know. I was sort of like showing up at a few open mics over the course of six months or whatever it was. Mm-hmm. But I say open mics, it wasn't. They were like bringer shows. So you have to bring seven people.
Fucking hell.
Those seven people have to have a 2-drink minimum. Part of why I think I had a tougher show on Saturday was because my husband was in. He's my husband. He's seen this show 12 times. Mm-hmm. I hate having people in that I know. And that impulse was that, like, some people are like, oh, I look out into the crowd and I see my friends. And I was like, whatever this is, I'm trying to learn. I want to do it on my own.
And partly that's informed by the fact that you would need to take your friends. You'd need to drag your
friends.
Yeah,
so you have to bring your friends.
I had no
idea. They have to spend money. You're asking them to then spend money in addition to their time. And I think there is a real open mic scene, but I just somehow wasn't dialed into that then. And I... I would say in some ways I still struggle to figure out how to write a joke, but like I didn't, whatever it was that I wanted to talk about, and also it's 22, and said with so many respect for our colleagues who are 22, I just didn't know what to do with this thing that I was interested in. And so I did 6 months of it. My anxiety was through the roof. I walked away. I was like, oh, I'll just write a little bit though. Because like if you're writing, you're sort of doing this thing that feels interesting, saying what you want to say, but I don't have to deal with that shit. Performance anxiety. And so I started doing that and it just like stand up, like just became this cancer for me. It was like, I thought it was the coolest thing. I thought like there was nothing in the world more powerful or cool than like comedians hanging in the back of a club, looking at their watch before they go on stage at the Cellar. Like what is cooler than that? And it was just this thing. And over the course of like years, people would say like, do you perform though? Like, are you, you seem like you will, you know, which is a criticism of somebody. But, and so that was sort of that. And I was just like, oh, thank you. And I would, the Moth is a storytelling organization in New York, which I don't know if you ever have heard of.
Yes,
them.
I've not
but
participated.
But they have like a big, they have like this big old storytelling podcast. And so like once a month I would do story stuff with them. And I sort of felt good being on stage, but I didn't know. People would always be like, oh, you're a stand-up. And I'd be like, no, I just do this storytelling thing once a month. And it felt like just the bane of my existence, and I didn't know what to do with it. And I was working as a writer, and that was fine.
So what was the bane of your existence?
It felt like I would do this thing. I'd get on stage once a month.
Yeah.
And at the risk of sounding very American.
It would be great, and you'd be great at it.
I'd be great at it.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't know what to do with, like, I was working as a writer, and I was good enough to do it, but with this sense that I wasn't fucking great. Like, and why are we doing any of this stuff? It's so hard. It's so competitive. Why are you going to do it if there's not something in you going, but I can get great? Maybe I'm not right now, but like, I think if I this, I think I'm gonna.
Yeah, there's a trajectory.
There's some trajectory in all of our heads. Some of us are delusional, some aren't. Fine. And I just knew that I wasn't great at this other thing, writing. But I was like, I think the stage thing is my thing, but I don't understand. By this time, I'm in my 30s. Like, what am I gonna do? Fucking go to some open, like, I can't, you know, I'd been in New York forever and all this sort of stuff. And then,
Can I ask, yeah, what was working about your stage time with The Moth? What was it that was great about it? What was it that was great about you doing it? I mean,
well, so first, interestingly, I was thinking about this today. Like, I was inconsistent. Like, I wasn't always, because now I understand that, like, it wasn't stand-up. And, of course, with stand-up, we work, get it perfect, and then it can sing. Which, with The Moth, I was just sort of trying different stories out all the time, and there was this looseness, and sometimes
it's a more forgiving.
Yeah, and it's also, like, what I always say is that, I mean, first of all, American audiences in general, a different thing. I think that if you're, like, a UK stand-up, and then you go to, you visit the US, you do whatever you want. It's like you have been training for a marathon in the sand.
Yeah, sure.
And then you get to, and that is a compliment to a British audience. Do you know what I mean? So I just thought that I seemed authentic and comfortable.
Okay. Were other people around you inauthentic or less comfortable?
I think there was a self-serious is overkill, but there was I think I was the one, or one of the ones, there were a few, who sort of did the job and really was meant to be a comedian.
Sure.
Right,
sure.
And I think that can lend itself better to, so they had people in, a friend of mine who was at the time a proper stand-up. She was brilliant. There was someone else who was a serious writer, New York Times bestseller, incredible writer. The writer for me wasn't as adept at hosting. She brought a different, more literary vibe.
Of course.
The Moth is a really literary thing, so that fit. But I just think someone's up there who has funny bones.
Yeah.
And when you're hosting, like, I'm quite high energy, and I just think so much of what people want. Over the course of The Moth, it was 10 different people. You just want someone who's just gonna bring it back, bring it up, manage it, you know.
Be present in the room.
Be present in the room.
Have an elastic relationship.
When there's
with
a really sad story,
yep,
know what to do to reset.
Yeah. Whilst being respectful of the sad story,
you know,
to change the gear.
Oh,
yeah,
I think,
okay,
I'm good at that. I think, yeah, I'm okay at all that. And it felt like I was especially good at it. And I didn't know what to do with this thing that it seemed like I had a real knack for and that I then really enjoyed doing.
And what was your voice as a storyteller?
Filthy. Like, okay, just high energy and real. And I mean, I accepted and hated about myself. It's just so, like, I go to, like, dick and vagina so quickly. My in such a limited sort of idiotic way. So that, you know, I, like, would just have all these dirty stories and I'd try and make them work. And I, you know, I think I could tell a story about, like one of my brother found my grandmother's vibrator. Like, that's a thing that happened, like, at this point, 15 years ago. And I believe, I hope, that, like, I told that in a warm and funny and comfortable way. But what I'm not good at is, like, this funny thing happened on the bus.
Sure.
The way you get your token on the bus. Like, I can't, and I really wish I could. It's sort of limited in that way. I mean, I think I still am.
Because you need something, well, because you need something to have happened, like an event, rather than an observation. Is that...
Yes, I think stand-up has helped me get a lot better with sure. that. But yeah, I knew...
The observations in your current stand-up show are fantastic.
Oh, well, thank
you. Yeah.
Thank you. I think... Here's the thing. I think I can observe okay.
Yeah.
The building up into a bit.
Okay.
Because there aren't that many bits in that show. I mean...
There are. It's friends, family, and...
Yes, yes, yes. But in terms of going, like... Oh, here's this thing, and now we'll expand it out, and here's a topper here, and now an act out here, and then we compare, you know, all those sort of real tropes of very traditional bits. If you knew how much I had to be talked, like, how much someone would have to break that down to make sure I understood it. I mean, it makes me feel like such a fucking imposter. That kind of stuff, I really struggle.
I'm only laughing. I'm sorry. I'm openly smiling at you in sort of affable derision because you're so good at all of that stuff. And I was just thinking, God, comedians are hilarious. Do you know what I mean? That kind of sense that I don't really know what this is whilst doing the thing that you're talking about.
I feel you saw a great show.
Okay.
You were in it a great show. And as we all know, like, that's very relevant and it's not relevant.
Yep. Yeah. Right? Very
so
well put. Yep.
So many moments in that show that can get in the wrong audience. Nothing for ages. But you were in with a great audience. So all these little things of mine... We're going off like bombs, and it's great.
Do you mean little things, material or persona?
Both. Like, so I talk about having a lot of charisma, which in the right audience, I like, it's clearly intended as sort of, I mean, like, I mean it, but it's a joke as well.
Sure.
And in that audience, people are like, oh, that's a funny way she said that or whatever. But in the wrong room, it's like, how is it funny that someone is just standing on stage complimenting themselves?
Totally. It's such a gamble as well, isn't it? Because yep. to say in a room, to do material, the platform, the base of which is, hey, we're connecting incredibly well because I'm so good at this. Like, right. If you're doing anything less than connecting
clearly
incredibly well.
You are clocking my high energy and warmth. Like, how can we not? So, but yeah, that sort of joke, certain kind of joke stuff is, so challenging to me.
Just as a little tangent, you said someone had to break down for you the structure.
Oh yeah.
What do you can you give us like the quick sketch of what that structure is to do a proper bit? What do you understand it as like the rules for?
Oh, now I'm like cracking under the pressure of thinking of a good example. Can I give an example of like a friend?
Sure.
So just because I sort of saw her work it up and I haven't seen her show yet, but I think it's in her show. So Susie Ruffle does this bit, which I think is in her show right now. I don't know if it is. But it's about, as a lesbian, going to see, like getting a pap smear. And so she builds it up in this way. And then part of the really... See, now I don't want to tell another comic's joke. What if I'm blowing her punchline?
Sure. Can you talk about the structure without giving away the words?
She introduces... Yes. She sort of introduces this experience that has happened to her. You know it's real, which is my... I mean, it's all I need in comedy.
Okay.
Just let me feel like this is real, not like you know, that shit you watch and you're like, you didn't say that to that person in that context.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm already checked out. I'm not going to laugh at the rest of this. But so you're already going, right, this is real. This has happened. And she gets this exam and, as a gay woman, is then told certain things about herself. And it's very funny. And then she goes into comparing this vaginal exam to another very different situation.
Okay.
And it's fucking, it's like, you know, as if this.
Yes, got you.
And
okay.
It's hilarious. And then there's a topper here. And this person said, you know, and she does an act out. And it's fucking killer.
I love when you see someone set up a thing perfectly and then begin an act out. And I always think it's such a have your cake and eat it moment, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because as a comic, and I don't even know what audiences think anymore. But as a comic, I'm just looking at it going, you're going to embody all of the things you just said, and you're going to get an extra laugh for each one that's more than double the original point.
Yeah.
It's wonderful.
And all, exact, sort of exactly what you just said were all those things. And that kind of, that exact comedic moment is one that feels like it still sort of eludes me. And I think there are plenty of other ways I can go about getting laughs, and, you know, and I'm very physical, but that exact thing is not where my brain goes to naturally.
When in the pathway from the moth to stand-up did you write the books that you've written?
Oh, so before, like, so I went to a moth show, like, so I'm doing stand-up, it's 2002, I do it for 6 months, I hate it. A friend of mine is like, there's this thing called The Moth, which is more long-form story, you might be into that. That's like in 2003. So I start sort of going to that and telling stories there. And I'm better at that. And through all that, wound up getting a book agent. So sort of through, like, my books were published in 2009 and 2014. So that was sort of me writing.
And was that writing the result of stories that you'd worked up on stage?
Some of it, yeah.
Okay.
Which is, I mean, in my first book, yes. In my second book, not so much, which is why the first book was better than the, like, it was classic sophomore slump. In some ways it was better. But, you know, so that was all, that was, you know, I was sort of doing those things and then hosting this moth thing once a month. And then my husband, who is British, we met through a moth show. Like, he had a colleague, they were in New York working, and he had a colleague who was, listened to the Moth podcast. I was like, oh, a fun thing to do would be to go to this thing. They work in radio. They were down a guest. They were like, get that lady on. That's how I met my husband, and he was like, you're a stand-up. And I was like, oh, don't even. It's all I've ever wanted to do. And I just don't, you know. I just think that ship has sailed, and that's fine, because it was just a source of such profound anxiety for me for, like, the 6 months I did it. So that sort of began this that was, like, our first date.
Okay.
Was him being like, this is this. In the UK, people are like that. And it's, I don't think it's as regimented in what it is, you know, and all this sort of stuff. So, like, this seed got planted while I was working on my second book. And I sort of started thinking, I don't think this is the life for me, this writing. I can't. The first, like, writing a book for the first time was really exciting. Oh my God, I'm writing a book. I'm going to have a book. My name is going to be up. And that was something. And then working on the second one, I was like, you, it's like being in a marriage that you know needs to end. You know, the sense of, like, I'm in this thing, but and it's good, it's fine, but something is telling me there could be another thing for me.
Okay.
Like, I think that was exactly that feeling. And, you know, so my husband had planted this seed, and I started thinking, like, when this is done, I think I need, I'll be, I was, you know, there was now, like, a plan to move to London. I was going to be in this whole new city. It felt like I could be a new person, reinvent, right? Like, all that shit is relevant.
Yeah. And if it's your husband that planted the seed of stand-up, he can't then, or it's harder for him to blame you when you have to be away all the time and traveling.
Yeah,
to
I mean, whole separate
He's comedy widowed himself.
Yeah, whole separate. I mean, and there's no one who's, like, more poorly positioned to be a comedy widow. I mean, it was like so, like, he would say, like, I just want one of us curled up at the other one's feet forever. Like, he is so codependent, you know, so there's that in a nice way and an exhausting way. But, so that sort of got the seed planted, okay. And it became like, okay, when this book is done, that will be, like, I will force myself to try this thing.
Just before we move on from the books, it's interesting to me that you would say, and I realize you could have then qualified it, but that you would say the first one was great, the second one wasn't as good, or there was a sense of it being a marriage that has
to
end.
Yeah, and first of all, neither of them were great. That's just true. Like, they were, there was some stuff about, like, it's that thing, like, Do you write?
No, not really.
No.
I mean, no.
No. That sounds... You all do everything, Stuart.
No, I mean, I write, you know, I spend a huge proportion of the last 10 years or 15 years
writing.
But do I write properly for things that can bear scrutiny? No.
Please. I think that, you know, stand-up is a very high form of writing. But yes, I meant prosy, booky.
Sure.
Booky stuff. You know, it's like sometimes I'll like pick one up and look at it and I'll be like, excuse me, but that was a beautiful sentence. Excuse me, that is very dense. I think I could, but as books, you know, it's a 20-minute club set versus an hour, right? Yep. It's like people can do different things. And there are people who are brilliant for 15 minutes, but fuck me, I don't need to see an hour. Mm-hmm. That's not for me for an hour. And I think I could have been, and maybe I will again, like, I think I can do an essay. I think you want me to give you 800 words. I think it can be pretty funny and solid in 800 words. I didn't need to do 80,000. I didn't. It was a boring book to read. I think it was funny. Like, I think I could be funny, but I just wasn't born for it, you know?
Were you... Oh, because you had not yet developed your stand-up persona at the time you were writing. So I guess you had a writing persona.
Yeah.
Did you feel like a version of you? I don't talk to many long-form writers.
Yeah, but I think that was what was wrong with my writing, is that it was too narrow. Like, my favorite stand-up, you know, is usually sort of like you meet the person, and it's very, like, we're all turned up a little bit. Who isn't? But it's just very close to who you see on stage.
Yeah.
And for me, the stuff where you're always like, is something clicking? Is something not clicking? It's because, like, whatever it is that's meaty on them as a person isn't making its way up there.
Okay.
Or there's just nothing meaty to them as a person, so how are you going to be into the stand-up, you know?
Sure.
And I just wasn't fully my, I don't know, I'm like... I don't know. You know, it's so funny. I haven't looked at those books or really been in that headspace for a long time. But I just think they were exhausting books to read. You know? Like, I think that they weren't... I just wasn't proud of them.
Okay.
Like, if you were like, sir, it was so fun chatting with you. Like, I'll definitely read your book. And you meant it. I'd be like, can we leave it with you seeing me have a good show the other night? Like, can we leave that there?
I think that is something that to me seems... I love hearing people review their own work. I love hearing people be critical of their own work. You know, in a wider, critical, in a rigorous kind of way. It strikes me as that's something that is quintessentially you, to be able to be swinging about your own work that is currently still on sale on Amazon. I looked at it. I read a sample from one of them. It made me laugh. I thought it was funny. I thought it was very funny. The stuff about your three imaginary friends in the toilet.
That is funny.
It's funny. It is funny. But it seems to me something that's very you. Like, I don't feel I could ever, with a thing available online to buy still as a going concern, I don't think I would sit in a sort of effectively a public forum and go, oh, Christ, you shouldn't buy that. It's dreadful.
I know. But
do you mean?
I
but that kind of, it's quite relentless, that honesty of yours, which I think is a part of it.
Yeah, I think that's kind of my deal. And I think that, like, I'm now just, like, praying that my agent will not hear this. I think, you know, it's funny because I do not know... Like, I think that the way that self-promotion works, right, is for me, or the people that I want to talk to, is like that you strike someone as funny. So, like, someone listens to this and is like, I was very into the vibe. I'll see that show. It's not going to be... Because I'm not saying I'm right about this. I don't think I am. I'm just telling you what is knocking around in my head. It's for me, it doesn't make sense because I would never listen to someone go, yeah, the show, I worked so hard. I'm really proud of it. I think it's the most me thing I've ever done. And then I would go, and maybe that show's great. I've heard people talk that way and then been impressed by the work. more often than not, I think people don't know what the fuck they're talking about when they talk that way about themselves. So if I hear someone go, I don't fucking know, Stuart, I'm, you know, I think this, but this, I go, that bitch has a realistic assessment of shit. That's what I'm into. I'll go see that. And that sort of like, you said relentlessly critical, right? But to me, it feels like just an honest appraisal of things.
Yes.
That's what would appeal. It's not a choice.
Sure.
You know
what
I mean? It's not like my strategy, but I find, and it's sort of why when like people talk about Americans being this way, and I know it's true, you know what I mean? But it is so anathema to me to sing my own praises in a certain way that when anyone does it, I don't understand. And the world is changing and people do. And there's a real sense of like, listen, we are professionals. We have to do this. And I think that's really smart. I don't disagree with that. But I really struggle to do it in a way that feels authentic to me. And the people who are good at it are doing it in a way that's authentic to them and funny still and self-aware.
Yeah, it's incredible, isn't it?
I think, I don't know how to do it.
I think you've hit on a fundamental there about, of course, the people listening to this who are going to enjoy your show and who are going to become your standard bearer fans, people to whom you are new, are going to hear you talking like this and go, I get her vibe. I want to hear more of that. And of course, that's exactly right. And yet we are all in this kind of, we're all part of the squeezed out toothpaste of having to monetize, having to amplify and boost and promote the thing. So do you have like a running battle with your PR where they're going, can you please tell people that you're good? Or your agent? Or, you know, you said, oh, my agent, I hope my agent doesn't hear this.
No, I mean, I think they, like, so in fairness, I haven't, like, I was with a friend the other night who was like, oh, I've been chastised. This is embarrassing. Will you take a photo? I need to Instagram. I've been chastised for not doing it enough. I put an Instagram post up the night my show ran, and I am not been on Instagram. I check my phone. This is not going to work in audio, but I hold my hand over my phone so I don't have to see anything going on Instagram. So I can see just at the bottom if I have notifications or just at the top if I have a message.
Yeah.
Because I don't...
Because you use it as an inbox. Like, that's exactly how I use it.
That's sort of how I'm trying to use it. And it's like, and I think, you know, what I really think is, and this is me inching towards saying nice things about myself in a gross fucking way, is that some of the people whose work I admire the most. I mean, the stand-ups where I'm going, that is fucking stand-up. That is not relying on A, B, that is just someone who is fucking born for this and they are brilliant. And they are never on Instagram.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm going to be that good. I'm going to be so good that I don't have to be like, sold out Born today, guys. No judgment. Judgment.
Let go. Sorry.
No. The thing is that I don't know. I'm certainly not now. And maybe I'm not. And maybe I fuck myself. And maybe the people who are, they shit themselves a little bit. They're like a little, they don't want this. They don't want that. But they go, you know what? Fuck it. I am working really hard. I want this. I don't already, like, you know, I think I truly feel that that judgment on my part is not fair because people's positions are different and they can do it better or they, whatever. But, and it's a real struggle for me, like, to figure out how to promote myself in a way that feels right. And I think that to just be like, ugh, like retweeting praise is stupid. Isn't right. I don't think thinking about it that way is quite. I've heard too many smart people explain to me why it's an okay thing to do. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. Anyway, I think my agent, like, there was like some article that ran and she referenced something about self-deprecation. And it was so minimal by my standard that I didn't even clock that I'd done it. And it was like, come on, like, you're working really hard and there's been this and this and this and this and this and this. And I just think, like, you know, and she was absolutely right. And so I'm trying to, I'm trying to find a way that works for me, but I'm not making any headway.
So this is Sarah. We talked a little bit about the moth there and her background. I think she's someone who I could see myself going to in the future for a bit of help with story structure. We don't really talk about that much in stand-up comedy. Either you have a director or not, and exactly what the director does to or for your show is often a sort of how long's a piece of string question. But we don't really talk about script editors. You sort of see them on TV shows or, you know, mysterious program associates, kind of quasi-credited writers. But in terms of creating stand-up comedy hours, a script editor or a sort of a story structurer or a dramaturg or something like that isn't something that you hear talked about. And I think Sarah, both from her work and from her background, clearly understands how a show smashes along and gathers pace. And she's someone who I will always look forward to seeing her hours, because I know that the content will be good, the performance will be fantastic, and the structure will just make it seem easy. And that's what we all want at a festival when you've seen 8 shows a day. You want to go and see someone where you breathe a sigh of relief in the first 2 minutes because you go, ah, this person. I'm reminded, what's that line from South Park about Michael Bay? Say what you like about Michael Bay, the son of a bitch knows story structure. So more from Sarah in just a second. A quick shout out with some tour dates now. I am in October. We embark on the second leg of the tour. Two little explanatory things. The first leg of the tour was when we just had our new baby. Future Girl had just turned up. So I made sure that the first leg was all places much nearer my home, which means now on this second leg, I get the joys of not entirely sequential, but almost pinging from Aberdeen to Swindon. There's going to be a lot of places coming up on the... There's going to be a lot of places coming up on the tour. Who says that? I've just caught myself big, terrifically... Well, if not ungenuine, it's because I was filling whilst I turned my phone round so that I could see the thing. There's going to be a lot of places coming up on the tour. Who's this fucking idiot? So, happy to report, the last time I read all these tour dates out, I got confused and was apparently going to Glasgow twice and didn't know the dates. These are all official tour dates. In October, I'm on the 5th of October, I'm at The Stand in Edinburgh. That's an early show, starts at 5 p.m, just the hour. On the 6th of October, I'm at the Aberdeen Comedy Festival, which I've never been to before. That's very exciting. The 11th, I'm at the Northampton Royal and Durngate. Lovely room. 25th of October, I'm in Tynmouth Pavilions for the very first time. The 26th of October, I'm at the Swindon Arts Centre. And then looking ahead, in November, I'm at Nottingham and Birmingham Glee Clubs. I'm going to be at the Comedy Box in Bristol on the 8th of November. Let's fill that one up, please. And then in December, all I'm doing in December, tour-wise, is the Westie in Aldershot, which is one of my very favourite rooms. And then in January, I shall be in Corsham at the Pound Arts Centre. And then the last 4 dates on the tour are Newcastle Stand. That's another early show at 5 on the 1st of February. 2nd of February, Glasgow Stand. 7th of February, Farnham Maltings. And we conclude the tour on the 28th of February in the Big Room at Cambridge Junction, which I'm very much looking forward to as well. All of those, and I think we're trying to smuggle in York and Leeds in there as well. So watch this space or go to comedianscomedian.com/tour in order to connect with any of those. There's a little page of links, all of which have now been rigorously tested. That's how rigorous the procedure has been. The word rigorously has snuck in. More from Sarah Barron now, and no extras from this stuff. We had prior commitments, both of us. No, I'm lying, actually. She had prior commitments. I was just kind of lying around the flat. So we only managed to do this little hour and 10 or whatever the edit produces. No extra content, but all of your extra content from any episode that has any, including some really fascinating stuff from the last 2 shows with Heath McIver and the puppeteer and creator and performer of Randy the Puppet, a.k.a. Randy Feltface, a.k.a. one of the best stand-up comedians, even despite the fact he's a puppet. So Heath McIver extras and Rob Orton extras. Lovely, lovely, wonderful Rob Orton. Those are all available for insiders only at comedianscomedian.com/insiders, where you can also join up for a regular monthly subscription, which will give you access to all the extra stuff on a private podcast, which has also recently seen a little pilot of a thing I'm considering doing. So thank you very much to everyone. Oh, no, I didn't put it on the private pod. Maybe I'm going to do a second draft of it and put it on the private pod, because actually what I did was use the sort of workspace app that the insiders all use to gossip with me and each other. It's like kind of ultra Facebook and even more relentlessly nice. I put a link to this little pilot of a new project of mine in the workspace app. So if you're an insider and you've not checked that recently, you can find that there. Or I'm going to come up with a second draft of that pilot this week, and I will put that on the the private pod. So all of that extra sexy secret content at comedianscomedian.com/insiders. Let's get back now to Sarah Barron.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
I came away the way I described you to my wife, because I am unofficially scouting for shows to send my wife to as well.
Oh my god! Comes, yes,
yeah,
great.
She'd absolutely love you.
Great.
And one of the ways I described you was, oh, you're going to love her. She's acerbic but really accessible, and she talks like Jonathan Van Ness. Right?
Oh my god! That is so weird. On stage 2 nights ago, I was like, I said out loud, I am just talking like Jonathan Van Ness.
I'm so glad, because that's certainly not critical, but also our voices are very important to us, and I don't want to suggest that you're in borrowed clothes at all.
No.
But you have, there are rhythms which are, they don't belong to him necessarily, but they are.
I know, it's getting worse, I think. In the days since you've seen it, because I've been binging on Queer Eye, I think it's getting more extreme. I have to tone it down a little bit with that, I think.
But the sorts of, for people who don't know who Jonathan Van Ness is, he's one of the presenters of the show Queer Eye, and he has a wonderful way with language. He really does. I feel like everyone I've spoken to has the same appreciation of JVN, which is that when they started watching Queer Eye, they were like, that guy is too much. And now they barely even notice the other four, because it's all about him.
He is, it's so, I was saying this to my husband, who doesn't watch Queer Eye, and I want, because like, he actually is very much the kind of guy who would.
Sure.
But what he doesn't like the repetition of a makeover show. So
fine.
Anyway, he's the most watchable TV presence I have seen. Him and Tan, I could watch it could just be Tan looking at people in clothes and being like, okay, we're going to do this. And Jonathan Van Ness, he's like, we can do this moment, we can do this moment, we're having this moment right now. I was like, and you know what's interesting is that I saw, when I was binging on RuPaul.
Yeah.
I mean, people were like, you're binging. I think I was moving like I was walking down a runway on stage.
Yeah, right. Okay. Yeah.
I mean, I think I'm very easily influenced by certain camp aesthetics.
My equivalent of this, having also binged on RuPaul's Drag Race, was my infant son doing, not swimming unaided, because he can't do that yet, but he achieved something particularly, I think he was holding these two little floats, kicking and managing to blow bubbles in the water as he went, for the first time during a toddler swimming class.
Yes.
And I said, yes, queen.
Yes, queen.
And then I was like, oh, looks around.
We're like, we all know what he's been doing.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. So that, but that, like, where does his voice come from, and where is it that the two voices meet?
I have no idea. It's not a thing I hadn't even remembered. That was just so, that I have no aware, anything, our JVN thing, non-existent. It was just, I was on stage on Saturday. There's a bit where I talked to the audience, and I said, I was like, I mean, I am fully sounding like Jonathan Van Ness, but this doesn't even matter. We're going on to the next part right now. I've been watching too much Queer Eye. I have to stop. And I hadn't thought, I had no memory that that happened.
Sure.
Until just now when you told me that's what you said about me.
But it's also, it's the lexicon, and I wonder whether it's a New York thing. I don't know where he's from, but
no, we're both from Illinois, actually.
Ah, well, that's interesting.
But I think it's
little trills, like referring to your vagina as your vagine.
Yeah.
And do you know what I mean? Those kind of like, that kind of, it's there for everyone. It's not there for straight men particularly, but it's there for men and gay women.
Self-deprecate again. Okay. I think those are like little, you know what I was saying to you, like if I have a tight crowd in, there's like, Like, I use the word vagine is a flourish because I don't have another joke there. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Like, that's some filler.
Well, it's...
I think it's... Here's the thing. I think when I was working as a writer, I would feel about... And I used to, like, you know, write in the day, teach at night. Like, I would do, like, adult continuing ed writing classes. Teach them. And, like, one of my rules was that if you're putting... If you're writing, like, a comic essay, which was sort of what people were working on, every sentence needs to move story. You're either moving your story forward, you're establishing character, or it can just be a laugh. If it's not doing any of those three things, it's gone.
Okay.
And then you like apply that even to the, just the word, does a word serve that? And vagine, like I'm establishing character.
100%.
Right? But a note I was given was like, I used the word cunt a few times in my show. It's like there's a whole bit. So like some of the notes have been like cunt. Oh, we were talking about
this. We were talking about each other.
Gosh, right. We cunt quota and vagine quota.
Yep.
Vagine is obviously less of a bomb, but it's, you know, a law of diminishing returns. And I don't even know how many times I say vagine in my show, but it's more than a one time. And like a few months ago, a few people were like, you gotta, less is more.
Sure.
For your vagine, less is more.
What conclusions have you come to thus far on the cunt quota? Because you have a whole section in the show.
Oh,
it's
yeah,
like,
where I use
it's
the
like
word...
friends, family, am I a hero or a cunt? And that's those are the three kind of...
Yeah, so the way I think of it is husband, friends, family, celebrity, me.
Gotcha.
That's sort of how it goes in my head.
Is that how it goes in your head because that's become your set list, or is that... Was that the structure of what you set out to write?
Oh, because that's... Because, oh, it's certainly not what I set out to write. I mean, I set out to write this show that was about whether we are like, are we good? So a working title for me at one point was The Coconut, because there's this idea, but it's not popular enough of an idea, and I thought it was a shitty title, which is like... If there are two people on a desert island, stranded on a desert island, and there's one coconut, what is the fundamentally most natural behavior? To share the coconut or to try to kill the other person for your own survival?
Sure.
And my husband is like, people share a coconut. I think it's what people do. And I'm like, people would kill each other for the coconut. Like, I think we're terrible. Like, I think we're so, like, really quite selfish. And I think that there's beauty and decency, but that it can take so much to get to the beauty or decency, or that a certain selfishness underpins a lot of charitable acts, all this kind of stuff, right?
Okay.
So that was sort of the idea. It's like, are we good or bad, you know? And I think there are echoes of that in the show, but that's not quite, you know, as ever. I mean, you've written more shows than I have, I presume, you know, but it's sort of like having gone through two, it seems to me in October, you're like, oh, here's an idea. And then yeah. By the following August, you're like,
you've got to go vague title.
Yeah.
You've got to go vague yeah, title. Yeah, you don't want to be trying title. To prove a thing that you set out to prove that you've written your way 6 months away from.
Exactly. So it was just sort of writing, you know, essentially kind of writing to a theme a little bit, seeing what was coming up in the club stuff that I was doing. And then there was this one part of the show, which I talk about, I do this bit about my grandmother and my dad, and that, like, I still don't love how it's sitting, but you take your exam on the 31st of July and you just gotta sail with it. Because it was basically doing the same, I have like a big set piece ending story, right? And it does a job and lands me where I need to land for the end of the show.
Yes.
And there was this other...
And it's totally captivating, incredibly honest, and scandalous,
yes.
And totally you.
Yes, I mean, all those things are right. So I had another story that wasn't scandalous, it wasn't as big, but it was the same, the device it was going to do in the show was identical. And there were, and I was like, and it was, and I thought it was really fucking good. I was like, this is fun, this is beautiful. And it just didn't work because essentially it was telling the same joke twice. So I have done so much work to take this perfect story and futz it around so the point of it is different and move it earlier in the show.
Which story is it?
It's the stuff about my dad and my grandmother moving into this bit about race.
Okay, okay.
Which I do. And it's not like, you know, and I've taken some fat out since you've seen it.
Okay.
But it's still, the point of that story is that I am judging my family. But fuck me, I had a better point.
Yeah.
I had a better point.
Some rigorous editing going on here. Because I'm interested in the relationship between someone who has written monologues, comic essays, and enough of them to fill two books, and how that person approaches stand-up. Now, you haven't approached it in a dry and academic way. You approached it because you are, to your bones, a stand-up. But maybe one of the things you've taken with you from that experience, that level of experience, is the ability to edit, such as you've just described.
Oh, yeah. And I think actually, here's a nice thing about myself. I think that I'm really, like, this thing that I learned last year working on an hour for the first time, and I had a director, and she was Jess Foscue, fucking brilliant.
Great.
I don't know if she's directing much. The point is, I think she's the best of the best. I didn't work with a director this year, largely because I was spending more money on The Fringe generally, but I was like, oh, like a lot of Jess is really good with jokes. So she did wind up helping me a lot with what I think is my weak spot. But I was like, structure is my strength. I got structure. I'm not like great with a callback, but I can figure out a link and this is this and this.
Anyone could do a callback.
I mean, the big callback in my show, honestly, was a comic open mic night. A new material night,
sure.
And me like working this story out, and then at the end of it being like, I don't know what the end is, but this is the point, right? It's this, and she was like, callback. It's, and I was like, oh my god. So I really like when I talk about imposter syndrome and all that. Mm-hmm. It's really you saying anyone can do a callback, and me being like,
is a callback is one of the most simple stylistic and structural tricks. And what I'm interested in is the structural skills that you have outside of it's route one structure is a callback.
Yeah.
Whether or not you have an innate ability to spot one, put it in the right place. Of course, there are Liam Williams calls arbitrary callbacks, which I love. I mean, fucking this festival is awash with them. And there are brilliant and meaningful ones. I don't mean to denigrate those skills. No. But tell me about the structural skills that you...
I just think I know how to shape something. I think I'm good with momentum. I think I'm good. You know, people are always like, don't overthink your links. And I agree with them. But I think that, you know, what I aspire to do in a show is avoid a 40-minute slump. Like, that's this thing that people talk about all the time. And I'm like, I think I don't...
Yeah, we're all trying to think of fun things to do at the 40-minute moment rather than eradicate the problem.
Yeah, and I think that, and again, this is not me saying that I think that I have succeeded in this, but I think that, like, that the right show doesn't have to have that. And it's not because a funny gimmick comes in at 40 minutes. It's because we're moving, and it's because we didn't know that we, like, my proudest moment of my last show, and it wasn't a lie, it was a link, was I was doing my motherhood section. So I was on motherhood, and I knew that the next place I needed, like, as I was putting the show together, I had a story about being fucked by two guys in the same day, right? Two dicks in a day. Hashtag, like, the best, right? And so the joke was, like, motherhood. I've seen my son has toddled, but he's walked toward me for the first time and said mommy for the first time. Two dicks in a day, better. This is the bit, right?
Okay.
So that's where I need to get.
Yeah.
How the fuck am I going from motherhood to, like, my promiscuous 20s?
Yeah.
And I fucking found a way, Stuart. I can't remember right now what it was, but it was just a sentence that got me from A to Z. And sometimes when, you know, fellow comedians or whatever would come in, they'd be like, the way you got. And I was like, Thank you, right?
Yes.
Because that was months of finding the perfect thing.
Yeah.
And I didn't basically, and I, you know, I hope that my show this year is as, you know, is good and all that, whatever. But like with this particular story that I had to move from the end to the middle, I didn't, you know, a second hour, you don't have as much time. And I never, I've not quite nailed that thing. And it's fine. If I'm having a hot show, no one notices.
Okay.
But on a Saturday night, it was a little more, I could feel the audience being like, we've been on board. Is there another laugh coming? Is that, a, you know, that sort of stuff. And I've taken some stuff out and I'm working it. Get it solid by the 7th. That's what I'm telling myself.
Your photos, your image,
yeah,
is really austere and really stern. And to me, doesn't capture the warmth that you have on stage. I've said it.
Great.
The last 2 years, I've seen your photos and they seem kind of clinical. They seem so high status and almost brittle.
Oh.
And then I thought, well, everyone tells me she's great. Not that I wouldn't see them because of you,
no, but
maybe
given
a choice of things, I went, she looks a bit cold. And then I saw you and I was like, this isn't the woman. For, when you walked out, I was like, this isn't her.
This is the, you were like, this is such a warm lady. I'm so warm.
Yeah.
I mean, this is all I'm going to talk to my husband about when I leave. That's fascinating. No one has ever said that to me. And I know you're completely right.
I don't know if I am.
Completely right. Okay. It's like you know when you know things. And my whole show is about how I think my judgment is like better than anybody else's on the planet. You're completely right.
The photos are of an element of your persona. But that element is, whilst it's a huge core of your persona, that critical,
here's what I'm taking
acerbic
from this,
thing.
Is that what I think I, which was what you said, to your wife about me, which I was like, he really sees me. You know, what I want to be is sort of fucking acerbic, like she is aggressive, but so warm. Oh, the warmth. And you're right that there's nothing, like a real, and I've been, certain previews that I had that I would struggle with, a thing that Lou Sanders said to me, we did a bunch of previews together, and she was like, off stage, you're so warm. And there's something in a tight room, which you haven't seen me in a tight room, right? They're not seeing the warmth. And it's not a different line. It's a twinkle in your eye. It's a way you're
no
talking to them.
And
you're
photos.
Saying there's no twinkle in the photos. And I know in my bones that you're correct. And I think that the way that that wound up happening was... Not last year, but this year, there wasn't a consensus on photos. Like last year, last year was so different. I didn't have an agent. I didn't have I didn't have anything. So it was just like me left to my own devices. And I love looking to camera. Personal taste. So I took this. So then it was like once everything was. So that sort of was just like a decision that got made. This year, I think there was this real preoccupation with making me look high status and making me look like a boss lady.
Which you absolutely do.
Exactly, which I do. An alpha, right? This is not zany. This is like...
Sure, that's valid because...
It does all that.
It does do all that, and that's all important.
But,
and that's a flavor. It's a strong flavor that we're not seeing anywhere else. So it does that job.
But it has been, I now realize... The cost of that has been my warmth. And what's so interesting from you is that we don't know each other. Like, up until a few days ago, we didn't know each other.
Sure.
So anyone who knows me, when you're like, wait a second, this is the lady from the poster?
Yeah, yeah, sure.
Which nobody else... And
because
listen,
they already know you.
Because they know that how I am. So that is an incredibly useful and interesting thing that you said.
And also,
fascinating.
You are warm enough that I felt... Barely knowing you, I could say that. Although I did caveat it with, look, we can take this out if you like. Because I don't, it's an unusual thing for me to say on this podcast.
Yeah.
It's like, I got a bit of a problem with the way you do this. It doesn't seem to sit. So,
but that's actually not quite how it was, how you presented it. And it made you look so smart. That was like such a smart That was, I mean, this is such a smart observation. And ultimately what it made me feel was very seen.
Great. Great. I may not keep in the bit where you call me smart, but that's fine.
Oh, man after my own heart. It is. Anyway.
You are brilliant at admitting your flaws. You're great at admitting how horrible you are, how little you like your friends, how... For the benefit of the listener, I may as well be bathing Sarah in radiant sunlight.
I think it's like my great gift. I think genuinely I will say to my husband, you being married to me is a gift. Oh my God. Because you will never argue with anybody better than I am. Because I am so reasonable.
Unpick that for me.
Because of my flaws, because my ability, and he would say that like I'm good at it 60% of the time.
Okay.
But my abilities to, in the midst of things, go, okay, that's fair. Like my ability to not get defensive is world fucking class. And think how good that is. You're a married man. Think how good that is in the context of a marriage, someone who's not defensive.
Jesus Christ. Yeah. I say that because I'm the really defensive one. Not because I'm saying, no, going, marry my wife, my wife.
We're all defensive in a marriage.
I get like, super defensive when criticized. It's horrible.
And I think that, like, anything, like, so many good things in my life are about the fact that I'll go, yeah, okay, that's probably right.
Is that innate? Did you learn that?
This is like one of the great questions because it is what I think of as my most central quality and my greatest strength. And I'm 40. How are you? Do you talk about your age?
I'm 42.
Okay. I was going to say, I think we're...
Showbiz playing age 20 to 30.
Yeah. Same. I'm 25. Cool. I'm around the same age. So the midlife
thank
crisis...
Thank you so much. That was so American. Do you talk about your age?
Well,
I'm going to steal that phrase. And do you talk about your age?
Because yes. People in this business
I'm older than you are.
A lot of, you know.
I had Pete Holmes on the podcast in Montreal, and at one point he made a comment that sort of implied, oh, yeah, I said, I do that. And he said, yeah, you're like a younger version of that, and I'm older than you, mate.
you never know with people. And there's age, like because like all my comedy peers are like 26.
Oh, God, I keep finding out I'm the oldest person in the room.
Yeah, it's constant. So the midlife crisis is real. It is real. I think I've sort of avoided it only because I switched careers at 35 years old.
You didn't have a lull because you drove the plot through.
Yeah, exactly. And there are like prices I paid for that, right? But like, but that thing of like, so this is my life hasn't really happened to me just because I switched jobs at 35. But anyway, this is all to say, I think that, you know, at 40, 42, you know, we've known a lot of people. We've got friends that we've known for a long time. We've watched lives unfold from 20 to 40. And there's so many people that I look at, 40-year-old friends of mine going, whose life is not holistically a disaster, not, you know, but that marriage is struggling. That's never going to happen. You're not going to have kids, but you want them. That job is a fucking piece of shit. And it is so clearly connected to parts of their personality that they have refused to work on for 20 years. It's like because people are defensive. Like we'd be so, there's so much more good stuff that can come and I think I'm not defensive, and I think I remember, like, I have these, and, you know, I don't like saying nice things about my parents, just like I don't like saying nice things about my friends, or my husband, for that matter. But I have this very clear image. I must have been 6, and I'd, like, come home from school, and my mom was, like, putting a snack out for me, and someone had hurt my feelings or done something at school, like, it's, you know, school age. And I remember telling my mother about it and her saying, well, what do you think their story would be of it? Like, what do you think their perspective is? And which is cool parenting. I mean, I don't remember what the incident is. Maybe she should have just been on my side. I don't know. But what I remember is thinking in my head, she always does this. Like, she always asks me about the other person. And I do think it's sort of one of the things I hate the most about Edinburgh, having only, like, I'm, you know, a few days into my second full run, is it turns me, like the rest of us, into such a fucking narcissist. I'm really bad at thinking about other people. You know, in any conversation, I could sit there and think, well, Stuart this and Stuart this and Stuart this. So for me, I would make sure to I want to take care of Stuart in this way, in this way, in this way.
Yeah.
I'm really sensitive to other, you know, and I'm not when I'm up here because I'm so in my own fucking head about this and this show went this and it robs me of this thing that I think I give to people, which is like a real sensitivity and, you know, which to me is like somehow in the same thing as not being defensive, like opening up, it's so American, I know, but like opening, what's your perspective? Okay, let me hear about criticism. I will take that. I will greet that. You're probably right. You know, like.
That seems very mature. Do you read reviews? Do you read your reviews?
No. And in fact, like we're on a time constraint now. So I like there's all, and I know it's not the nature of this beast, but like there's something about reviews that I'm not handling correctly and I need help and I need advice. Like I'm seeing my producer today because I'm not doing it right. And I believe it. Like I'm going to identify that like last year, I was sort of without a team. So I didn't read any reviews, but I was scanning all the time and looking at other people. And it was just so toxic and bad. And this year, so I was like, I have this incredible team. You know, I have unbelievably diligent producer, a perfect agent. I don't have to worry about anything. I'll take myself out. I'm not looking at Instagram. I will not look at anyone's posters. I'm going into myself. I am reading. I am exercising. I am seeing films. And there was a reviewer in the night you were in, a man. There was some man scribbling. I don't know what these people look like, so I don't know who it was. I've been asked to not be told anything about reviews, but there was one nice one, and they were like, can we tell you about this one? So it's like the whole system is broken down. I don't know how to not know. I checked. I didn't read the review, but I looked to see who wrote it. It was a woman. So some man was scribbling who's reviewing me, and I haven't. So now I'm obsessed with where I got some shitty review.
Yeah, okay.
And I don't, and I think reviews are, I think the idea that, like, reviews are idiotic, it's stupid, these guys don't, I don't think that's real. I also have read, I have seen some shows that were, by my opinion, which I trust, true brilliance. Perfect stand-up hours, or perfect innovations, 3 stars. And I have seen piles of garbage, 3 stars. So I don't care, but I fucking care. And it's making me insane, and I could use some advice on how to deal with it.
That is wonderfully honest and comprehensive, and I really appreciate that. Because, particularly because when you were talking about not being defensive, I was thinking, like, I bang a drum for the fact that I don't read my reviews anymore. And that is a step along the way. That's an immature step along the way. The next thing is to stop banging a drum and just don't read them.
I know.
But I started, when you were saying I'm not defensive, I started thinking, maybe it's more adult. Maybe I'm burying my head in the sand. Maybe it's more adult to read them and care or not. So I'm thrilled that you don't read them.
Reviews is not defensive. Reading reviews is getting, like, this thing, I've never read a review, but I've seen little, you know, like, someone sent me something in a comedy, it was like, oh, you got in this thing, which is a positive, but it was something about how basic my topics are, because I talk about being in relationships, and I'll leave that there, because then there's some other stuff about, like, this person started the conversation on this, and I was like, I didn't know that I had a classic American this.
Yeah.
I didn't know that my topics were like, well, it's just talking about relationships. And I was like, oh, do we not? Oh, okay. Like, it's just, and these have been in positive things. It's like, there is nothing good. Nothing good to be gotten from reading your reviews.
They're not for us.
They're not
for
us.
They're not for us. They have a function of sorts. But they're not for us.
But, like, this is the thing, is that comedy reviews don't exist in the States.
Yeah, of course. So you haven't built up the,
no,
you haven't
it's
been
like,
through
and it's
years
like, and
worth
you hear,
of wondering
like,
how to deal with
big
it.
Big American comics talk about reviews.
Yeah.
And they're like, it's stand-up.
Yeah.
Like,
Yeah.
If it works, I know. If it doesn't, I don't. And then it's like, there's you know, it's my least favorite part of British comedy culture, the sort of review stuff, because it's like, we can work out what to see. And it's sort of like, we can all think, oh, well, this is this kind of thing, and this is this kind of thing, and this is this kind of thing. But if you can kill in the room, you're successful.
Yeah. The best thing, this is a way I think about them. One of the organizations here that reviews shows started printing biographies, little two or three line funny, folksy, jokesy biographies, and a photo of the person who reviewed you. And that was the best thing they ever did for a comic, because you could look at the review and go, that's not right. Oh, you're 19, and you aspire to being an actor.
Thank you for telling me
that.
At
the moment you work in advertising. Because you go, oh, right. Phil Jupiter said on this podcast a few years ago, very memorably, we were talking about tweets and insulting tweets and hate tweets and stuff. And he said, if you could see, there is something about the font, there's something about Arial Black or whatever it is that legitimizes it. If you could see their handwriting, you wouldn't pay them a moment's notice. Yeah. If you could see the person, if you could have a 2-minute conversation in the bar with the reviewer, not knowing they were the reviewer, you would immediately stop caring what this fucking idiot thinks about your show.
I know. And actually with this, a show that I saw that I thought was horrendous. So bad that what I said to my husband afterwards was like, I don't use the word stupid. Because I think a lot of us aren't stupid. There's other shit going on for us.
Yeah, yeah.
And we left there and I was like, stupid. Like it's pure stupidity. And I've known this person a while. I didn't realize quite how stupid they were. Stupid. 4 stars.
Sure.
And I said this to a friend who was like, yeah, yeah, yeah. But you know who the person was like, yeah, that made its way around our flat yesterday.
Yeah.
Intern at the.
Gotcha. Sure.
You know, and it's just, it's like you want to not care. And I, like, if I make a decision about a thing, if I go, then we are doing the psychological work. Last year was the work of you're not going to read it. Fine, got there. This year, Stu, is supposed to be the work of not giving a shit.
Yes.
And it's not working for me.
Yeah, yeah. It's very difficult. And listen, I want to caveat what I said about this fucking idiot. I don't mean all reviewers are fucking idiots. I'm assuming in that case the position of someone who has had a bad review and is feeling negative about it. I know people through doing this podcast. I have a sort of a weird quasi producer-ish role. At
Edinburgh. Yeah, weird.
I know some reviewers. I know critics. I know people at every tranche of the industry, and they are human beings just like us.
Yeah.
And they are trying to be at a comedy festival, which is a thing we love, and they're trying to get paid to be here so they can be here. That is laudable, and that's fine. But reviews are simply not for us. They're not for me to read. I haven't read my Chortle review for the last 3 years, and I know that I never will.
Right.
And that is the position that you want to be in, because I don't mind other people reading it and finding out what one person's opinion is of the show. Some reviewers are very articulate. Some have axes to grind. Some really like me and always say nice things. That's fine, but it exists in an ecosystem outside of my head and my work. So they're not for me, so I won't read them.
How long did it take you to get there?
Years.
Oh, God, years. Dude.
And now I noticed, I'm just starting to notice fringe benefits of this position of mine, which I've adopted for a few years now, which are that sometimes when I will write the blurb for the show, I'll pass that to my management and I'll say, add some quotes to this. And then on the back of my flyer, I'll read a quote I've never read that's very complimentary. And I'll go, oh, did they think that? Oh, that's nice. Move on. That is the most connection that I have with them. And it takes time to develop it, but remember how happy American comics are because they don't get reviewed in America. Why? It's a barnacle. It's a thing that drags, you know, it adds drag to the speed of your boat.
Yeah, I think, like, it's such a funny thing because I think, like, that a British comic can have and make a much better career for themselves on average than an American comic.
Because on average, that's exactly correct.
That's exactly correct, right? Because, like, you mentioned Pete Holmes before. I mean, hello, right? Like, sure. we all want to be Pete Holmes. We all want to be, like, Aziz Ansari, Amy Schumer, whatever. But on average, because I have some, you know, a good handful of stand-up friends back in the States. And, like, these guys are good. I mean, we're talking guys in their 40s. They've done their Letterman sets. They've done Colbert. They're good. They're working. It's great. And I know they're not they have nowhere near as many Twitter followers as, like, people here who got to do that panel show and got to do, it's just, that really creates an income stream and an exposure and all that stuff that is not available to those people in the States. And when they're traveling for gigs, they're flying across, they're getting on a plane, you know, and they're doing all that. But holy shit, to not have to do this review and the competitiveness, you know, I think is a real benefit.
Are you happy?
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Like, not right now. I'm in Edinburgh. Do you know what I mean? So I'm like, but I think that I feel like mostly quite satisfied by this job choice. And it's like been this thing. It's like, I was single for a long time, being like, I'd just be happy if I had a boyfriend. And then I met my husband and it was like, and he does make me happy, but also you're like, oh, right. There's just like, then you kind of like remember when it was easy when you were single. And then I wanted a baby so bad and it took us so long. And then we got one and I love him more than anything. Right. But you're like, oh my God, remember when I didn't have a kid? Like, remember when there was freedom in the, you know? And then it was like, I was open miking constantly, like in my 30s, you know, just be like, and I would see these other people doing these things and be like, when you're there, that's where the cool kids are. And now I feel sort of getting in with the cool kids, getting there. And I'm like, God, remember when there was just no stress? Like, remember when this just felt like this pure beauty? So it's like, I've had enough things now that have, you just go, it's just the positive. They're just nice and terrible things to every moment. So you just go, here's the great stuff about this right now. For a sense of perspective. So I think that I am.
What do you want long-term from comedy?
What do I want long-term from comedy? So it's sort of like, there's like a financial thing and then there's like a creative thing, right? So I think like, I want to be unfollowable, right? Like, I want to be able to be really good in some diverse environments. Do you know what I mean? So it's like, I think that if you're like a real innovator of one kind, a really alt, you don't have to fucking worry about doing well here. But if you are going to talk about relationships, you got to be able to like do okay in the Midlands. Do you know what I mean? Right? Like, you can't go like, well, fuck them, this, that, and the other. Right? So I want to be, like, really good. And a thing that, like, a thing I heard said about, or, like, I saw in a screen grab once, was, you know, talking about someone and saying, like, they had gone to see their hour. And the screen grab was something like, you know, they were great on this thing. But, oh, my God, you know, just the hour of stand-up, they are exposed. And I want to be, like sort of the goal is to be like, and if you thought that was good, you got to see her live. You got to see her live do an hour. That's her thing. So that is sort of the goal, I think, right? And then I'd like to make a lot of money. So then I'd like to, you know, be able to tour in places that are big enough that, like, I'm making a lot of money and can, you know, feel financially comfortable and safe and not sad about or scared about money. Basically.
So that was Sarah. You can catch up with her in all the usual places you'd expect to online, by which I mean Twitter, Instagram, and her own website, simply by putting her name into any search engine. So please feel free to do that. All of my tour stuff is at comedianscomedian.com/tour and comedianscomedian.com/insiders if you would like to hear extra content from all the episodes that have it. This one does not, but there's plenty of really, really good extra little gossipy, juicy, technical, or otherwise specialist stuff available there. Thank you so much to Sarah for coming on the show. I loved talking to her. I think she's a fantastic comedian and I'm really excited to see what she does next. And as I said, just she's I gigged with Liam Pickford recently. He's funny. And I described him as a double threat in that he's very, very talented. And I also find him very threatening. Well, Sarah is not physically intimidating in the same way that I consider Liam to be. But she just is such a complete package as a comedian. Really, really funny, relentlessly honest, brilliantly structured writing and just such a joy to watch. So please find her stuff wherever you can. And thank you, as ever, to Jake Crossland for the logs, to Robert Smouton for the music. I've just called you Robert there, Rob. Apologies. Rob Smouton for the fabulous ComCom music. To Nathan Wood, who is the editor, uploader, and what's the phrase? De facto. He's the de facto producer of this show. Your podcast consultant, as ever, is Peter Dobbing. Big love to Marky J. And I will post-amble at you after the break. Now, I don't know if Nathan left in the slightly slanging... What did I say? I harangued a reviewer, who an iTunes review, who had complained that the waffly bit at the end is too long. I don't know if Nathan left that in, but on the off chance that he didn't, the show ends now, angry iTunes reviewers. So you can't complain about any of the extra waffle I'm going to do now, because you have this opportunity right now to switch off. But it's literally only one person out of millions and millions of downloads, so it doesn't really behoove me to continue wanging on about it. Bye for now. I'll speak to you next week. Some blinders coming up. I rubbed my hands with glee as I looked at the 10 episodes that I currently have in the can, every single one of which is a total corker, he said in a sort of smash hits 1987 way. Bye for now. So, can I come up with a post-amble with my head jammed into a box full of memory foam? Well... this weekend, I have had a bit of a... I've had a bit of a mental health relapse. Oh, have I? No, not an official relapse. I just had... the cloud was overhead. And I just felt really sad. And I'm happy to say, at least, that one of the things I felt whilst being really sad and just feeling... God, I... This is one of those things you absolutely shouldn't say to millions of people. I looked in the mirror and I thought, God, I felt old. There's no point ever telling anyone that you feel old, because either they're older than you, in which case it's insulting, or they're younger than you, in which case they don't give a shit, or they are considering employing you and have changed their mind on the basis of how old you are. But with just taking into account what Sarah said near the beginning of this episode about when she was talking about her book and saying it's exhausting to write and exhausting to read, I really do love that, the idea that you just have to be honest about your back catalogue. If you have a show or a thing you're not proud of, the instinct is always just to sell, sell, sell. But yeah, I totally agree with her. The sorts of people whose opinions are important to me would appreciate the honesty of me going, for example, that show in 2011, God, it didn't work. I can't offer you your money back. But if you came to see that one, I hope you saw one of the few good ones, rather than me clunkily running through an exercise in sort of mental exploration and how not to write a show. So yes, I looked in the mirror, and there's been a lot of sleepless nights recently with the Boutros's illness and him sleeping in our room now because he's been poorly and snoring like a chainsaw through a mattress. And so more than usually tired. Keep forgetting we've got a baby, because we're so in the swing of parenthood that we forget. I forget that, oh no, you've still got a baby under a year old, and that is inherently difficult. My wife is having to take so much of the... It's hard, and I keep getting to escape, so I feel guilty about complaining about my lot, but I still want to complain about my lot, because, God, life used to be easier than this. So I just felt really sad. It probably is just sleep-related. And I just sort of felt the cloud overhead and that horrible feeling like cold water being poured down your back that just makes you think, well, not without any of the sort of exciting vibrancy, ALS challenge, bucket challenge. Obviously, cold water being poured down your back would sort of be quite fun in some ways, but just like you're wearing a wetsuit full of cold water that you just slosh around in all day. So apologies if you've interacted with me over the last weekend. I have mostly been sad. But, you know, life's still great. I had a really abortive phone conversation, like a Skype conversation with my... it wasn't Skype, in fact. If I'm going to drop a brand name, it was Zoom.us. Seems much more efficient. A conversation with my mum and brother where I was trying to get the Boutros to have a chat with them, and he was distracted. It was too near tea time. I was a fool to try and jam everything in. And I felt guilty already because we were long overdue, my mum getting to see her grandson online and getting to communicate with him. And then he didn't want to talk. And I was like, oh, God, now I'm worried about what they think about him and being distant and stuff. Neither of them are remotely worried. But I just ended up in a sort of awkward, anxiety-ridden clench, and then he legged it off to have his tea. And my mum made the mistake of asking me how I was doing, which you'll know if you saw Primer, is always one of those things. If anyone ever says to me, how are you? No, sorry, she said everything will be fine, not how am I doing, but that everything will be fine. And that is that's a big trigger. It's not a big trigger, but if it ever functions as a trigger, if I ever start getting teary because someone says it's all going to be fine, then that's like a big flag of like, well, you're feeling a bit sad and wonky then. You might have accidentally stumbled back into what my therapist used to call the horror dimension. Yeah. Although I suspect I came up with that. He just went, yeah, that's as useful a way of thinking about it as any other. Just to sort of try and build pictures and signs and some semblance of meaning when dealing with your own mental health. We came up with this idea that, you know, you find yourself... It always reminds me of Better Than Life from Red Dwarf. Have I talked about that before on the pod? You know, you're in this... God, it was from years and years ago, the crew from Red Dwarf find themselves in like this sort of awful version of reality, and they don't realise that they're all plugged into a virtual reality computer game because it's so realistic. It's called Better Than Life, and it's like a VR thing, but an all-encompassing one. And I've always thought that's an incredible metaphor for feeling depressed or for the horror dimension or whatever you want to call it, when it hides itself. The game Better Than Life hides itself from the players, so you don't know, you don't remember you're playing a game. You just think that's what reality is, and it's just like that, isn't it? So I stumbled into that dimension where everything in the world was and is as it is. It's just that it all feels a bit crap, and I feel a bit like I'm a bit pointless and all the rest of it. This isn't a very uplifting chat, I realise, but if you are struggling under these kind of things, just reassure yourself that even someone as apparently together as me, is that valid? I don't know. You hear a lot of my innermost thoughts. So maybe you think of me as someone who's got their shit together, and maybe you think of me as someone who, you know, depending on your position in the getting one's shit together strata, maybe you regard me as someone who's really on it. And maybe you regard me as someone who just can't function very well. But... certainly, if you're in the former group, then, hey, let's all be honest about the fact I had to have a couple of emergency cries in a room on my own over the weekend, because it may be of some value to you to know that that happens to, I was going to say, the best of us, but that would be naturally suggesting that I am the best of us. Ozymandias over here. All I mean is, it's happening to everyone, isn't it? And you kind of... Hey, here's a slightly more uplifting note. I've been watching Game Face. Have you seen Game Face? I'm so late to the party on this. Me and my wife have been sneaking in little 25-minute episodes of Game Face, which is, of course, Roisin Conaty's fantastic one-person show. She wrote it and created it and is starring in it. As far as I can see, there's no additional writers. I mean, whether there are or not... what an achievement. It's fantastic. Obviously, your nearest marker is something like Fleabag, but the tone is very different. And I would suggest if you enjoyed Fleabag, then go to Game Face, only because Fleabag is obviously sort of Emmy winning and, you know, has probably a bigger kind of cultural footprint at the moment. So if you're into that, if that piqued your interest in that kind of one-person self-generated sitcom where it's just one person's unique vision of the world, that's really the only similarity. Get yourself on Game Face. It's on 4OD and you have to watch the adverts. What is this? 2002? But what a show. So, so funny. Carl Theobald is in it. He's excellent. And lots of fun people who you'll know from the world of comedy keep cropping up in fun little cameos here and there. But it's so, so funny. And Roisin is so good at almost kind of exposing the rawness of the reality of her life. I know the character in the show and her are two distinct entities, but that those observations have to come from somewhere, and she's really good at just being crap in such a wonderful, raw, funny kind of way. So check out Game Face and let's leave it there, because I think all I'm really saying is I've been really crap and raw all weekend, but not necessarily in that funny of a way. But onwards and upwards, and love to all of you currently listening to this bit. And there's so much great gear coming out on the podcast, and there's so many great things in life, and I'm not going to spend this week in a wetsuit full of cold water. I'm going to manhandle myself out of that wetsuit. But I think a wetsuit is a good, it's quite good metaphorically, because if you've ever tried to get out of a wet wetsuit, it's not easy, even with that little long taggy thing on the zip. But we'll get there. Bye for now.
Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.